And who is
Hi, Fong just got in.
Oh, good. Hi, Fong.
Hi.
Is Charlie coming?
I haven't talked to him since last week. He didn't say he does not come in.
Okay, we'll expect him. We'll wait a few more minutes. While we're waiting, has everybody had a chance to look over the comments that were gathered from our last conference call and from the work that each of you did to make suggestions?
Yes, I did.
Yes.
I guess
I have not. I'm hoping to get that.
Okay.
Plan.
Go around.
Ann and Andy, I just sent those to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Let's see how fast the internet is.
And Fred, I don't believe we'll be able to be on, so...
Okay, so I guess we're waiting. Charlie, we'll wait maybe one more minute and then get started.
Craig Stewart's actually in Germany this month, for those who are wondering where he might be.
Okay.
Do we have a firm date on our resubmissions?
No, we don't have a date yet. We have to. We're going to need to get a receipt date.
Mm-hmm.
We have to do that, but we need to go. We ought to try to go ahead and lock one in already. Okay.
Okay. Let's get started. I think that I'd like to work from the document that we've started with and to, as we go through this, bear in mind the need to prioritize. We don't know what the final budget will be for this project, but it may not be that much more than what we're working with, and if it is, it will be a little bit more. And to bear in mind also that some of the projects have been funded with collateral use of other grants, so that as projects are submitted with full budgets and full funding, the actual number of projects may not change significantly. And so part of what everybody is going to need to do as we go through the suggestions that have been provided will be to begin to ask the question, how expensive will it be to do this project? Is there a way to reframe the project as it's being proposed in a very preliminary way? And given the cost of each project and the number of projects proposed, how many can we have? And then finally, what should they be? And that process, I think, is going to occupy us for the rest of this time. We have both hypotheses as well as projects, and for the most part, everybody stuck to the major themes that we thought would be important, and those are improved diagnosis, including development of biomarkers, pre- and postnatal interventions, and identification of moderating variables, roughly speaking. So those themes should be kept in mind along with the overarching theme of the first 5 years, or I guess 3 to 4 years of funding that we've had, which is how do we make this diagnosis in children who don't have obvious dysmorphology? What is the behavioral phenotype of the disorder? And how early can we push back the diagnosis to open the door for interventions that might be temporally limited in their effectiveness and perhaps ineffective at ages when we can now make the diagnosis. So the first set of comments were from Tina. And Tina, if you have your comments in front of you, maybe you want to just summarize.
Yeah, in thinking about early diagnosis, improved diagnosis, and including biomarkers, I guess I just wanted to bring up the possibility that we should feel comfortable that we have sufficient numbers and variability in the cohort studies to be able to do that, assuming that you need prospective data to be able to do that. And so that brings up the possibility of considering Rome as a possible site for an additional prospective study. And in terms of intervention, actually in terms of bringing in new investigators regarding biomarkers, Friedrich Wurst, I think, is potentially a person that we should invite at least to present to the group what he could contribute in terms of developing novel biomarkers that might be relevant to pregnancy and how that might apply. And in terms of intervention, I've spoken briefly with Claire Coles about what she would, if she were to propose to join the consortium, what she might propose to do. And she thinks that she has an interventional tool that's actually based on working with parents or caregivers to work with their kids, and is web-based, so it could be used cross-culturally, and it's possible that that could apply in more than one site, although right now I think it's geared to be used with pretty young children, so preschool age and maybe into early school age. And then I'm talking briefly with Charlie Goodlett and others about the potential for expanding on what we're doing in terms of nutrition across sites. I think that's important.
Mm-hmm. if you were to conceptualize this as a U01,
mm-hmm.
What do you estimate the cost of it would be?
You mean to incorporate into the Moscow site? All of those things, are you talking about? I'm not exactly sure what you're asking.
Well, yes, some of these things would be incorporated into other projects.
Right.
Claire's intervention program.
Right.
I'm not sure whether that would be, you've listed four possible sites.
Mm-hmm.
If I can interject too, just to ask the question, how early are we talking about in terms of intervention from Claire?
Yeah, I think she's talking about three-year-olds as the bottom end of the range, and that's based on her having preliminary data that suggests that it works in that age range.
And she's not talking about follow-up of any of the individuals in any of her or any of her cohorts younger than that?
That's not what she proposed in the initial discussions with her, but maybe it would. Maybe there's something that she doesn't already have preliminary data on that she would propose to do with younger children.
I bring that up because you're going to have populations coming along even younger than that.
Exactly. And maybe that would be an experimental, something that would be proposed that she doesn't have a track record on but would be important to try to incorporate.
Okay, because I think she's the only early childhood person that we have.
Right.
Okay, so if there's anyone who knows earlier than 3 years, it should be her.
Okay.
And just to think about it, is I think almost anything that we're talking about, if we're going to justify it as being a part of this rather than being a part of a separate, just a separate application that comes in, should be more than one site.
Mm-hmm.
So if Moscow is a site, then, we have other populations, too, coming along,
right,
including the Phil May population, which
right.
His new population in
South Africa. Right. Yeah, I talked a little bit with Ed about it, we were talking about Sarah's orphanages and boarding schools in Moscow as a possibility for having a captive audience where you could perform this young school age intervention or preschool age intervention, because the caregivers would be the same people. You wouldn't have to be going out like in Africa to wherever the the children were residing. But we did not discuss anything related to children younger than that, and maybe that would be something that Claire would be willing to develop a proposal.
But I think we should know the answer to that question.
Okay.
I'm just judging it based upon some other feedback that I've had for another project that was reviewed, and if you have the population, it may not go over very well to say, well, we're going to wait until they're three.
Three. Okay. And so, Michael, going back to your question, you would be then asking the question if an intervention proposal were to come in from someone like Claire as a UL1, what would be the cost?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and I don't have a clue. I talked to her a little bit about what she would think would be a reasonable sample size for the preschool age children, and she was talking on the order of trying to do something with 60 or 70 kids who were in the intervention group and then a similar comparison group. So I can go back to her and ask her to try to detail that out if it was done in at least two sites, what she thinks the ballpark cost would be.
And to ask her about Ken's question.
Exactly, I will.
How young?
Could this or some other thing be adapted to younger children?
Yeah, if not an intervention, at least some early childhood measures.
Okay.
It may be too early to intervene with an 18-month-old, I think we should be, thinking about is there something that should be done if we're looking for the earliest point of intervention?
Right. And it may be, the focus of this intervention that she's already got up and running is an intervention with the caregiver as it relates to what happens with the child. So maybe it is adaptable to younger children.
Yeah. Anne, what was the earliest you were ever able to take measurements on that were meaningful?
Well, the most meaningful measurements that we've had have been from our neonatal ultrasound.
Yeah.
I mean,
okay.
In terms of detection.
Well, in terms of behavior.
In terms of behavior, we used the Brazelton on day one of life in the hospital, and items that measured particularly habituation. Off the Brazelton, especially habituation to light, because that was the that was the first. There are three habituation items given, and the first one is light, a flashlight. And if the child wakes up to the light, then you can't give the others. So the light was the most habituation to light from the Brazelton scale. Was the most sensitive item to prenatal alcohol exposure across the first 7 years of life when we did the big analysis for the monograph at the 7 years. That was the single most important thing that we measured in terms of strength of relationship to prenatal alcohol.
And was it their failure to habituate?
Yeah. Yeah, failure to habituate. They got, it's such a basic biological characteristic. The more alcohol, they got increasingly aroused instead of being able to tune out the redundant stimuli that normally they would be able to do if something, a light were shown across their eyes. When they were in a state of light sleep. And many people believe that that's really some of the earliest roots of attentional problems. So that's why that was so interesting to us to find that. We evaluated all the other, items that we looked at across the first 7 years of life, and that was the most important.
And are you or is anyone else on the call familiar with whether using a similar paradigm people have found this outcome in animal studies?
Gosh, I don't know.
It seems
you sure could measure it in animals.
Yeah, absolutely. And
I mean, animals habituate too. Have to.
You could be very quantitative about dose and time and all the...
Yeah.
So that I'm going to just highlight that as...
That would be marvelous to see some animal studies. Some of the people that have tried to that have tried to give the Brazelton and in newborn babies have failed to deal with a problem of if you have a baby that doesn't habituate well, then you have a baby that's more likely to be awake or in a state of not being either asleep or awake. So we made it a requirement for all of our examiners, if they could not get the baby into the proper state to administer the Brazelton, they had to come back at the next mid-feeding point to examine the baby.
Yeah.
They couldn't just call that a failure. So a lot of people that have given the Brazelton have a low sample size.
Sure.
Relative to the whole Brazelton on the habituation item, because people don't insist that the babies get the habituation item.
Let me move us on, and I'm going to bring
sure.
up in the next one because it suggests something interesting done. Fred is not on the call, is that right?
No, I'm sorry. He had to go to New York.
Okay, so...
but I can, he'll be back tomorrow, so I can communicate with him.
So I'll just highlight what I took from Fred's comment,
uh-huh.
Which he had a couple of points to make. One of them, which he had mentioned in Rockville, was the importance of using multivariate statistics. The core of his suggestion really is the opportunity to use an early identifiable structural abnormality as a predictor of a neurobehavioral deficit. And I'm just curious now, as the two of you collaborate, whether you have any experience trying to correlate corpus callosum dysmorphology as determined by ultrasonography with habituation to light.
No. No, we did not have this was a tiny pilot study, and we did not have the resources to do behavioral assessments, particularly that would have to be done the first day of life.
But what about in your MRI studies that looked at corpus callosum dysmorphology?
No, that was with adolescents and adults, and we did not attempt to look at habituation in adolescents and adults.
So I'm not familiar with these data sufficiently. I'll have to educate myself, but wonder, since we're always talking about pushing the envelope back to as young an age as possible, whether this is not a metric, since it's fairly easy to do, that could be incorporated in some of the assessments of newborns, and certainly one for us to consider in some of the animal studies as well.
You mean habituation or the looking at corpus callosum?
Well, I'm just thinking that we have a number of studies where children are going to be followed prospectively through to term.
Right.
And whether in some of those studies, especially where there are going to be later neurobehavioral analysis, whether it is worth it to ask for this one measure to be done at birth.
You mean the neonatal ultrasound?
Well, with neonatal ultrasound or in the Moscow study, in any of the studies where cohorts are being identified before birth.
I think that would be fabulous, because what I visualize is the kind of public health application of this is that people would be identified, mothers that were heavy drinkers would be identified from prenatal care that most countries have, and then those babies would be slated for a neonatal ultrasound before they left the hospital. And then the mother would still be there and the baby would still be there, and you could get both of them into early intervention programs. Because frankly, if you're dealing with high-risk alcohol-abusing mothers and you want to do some early interventions with them, with the babies, the first thing you have to do is get the moms in some kind of care, so you know, to deal with the disruptive lives associated
right.
with their alcohol problem. And then, you know, then you can, you know, you can treat them, and that, and you know, we have a model for that here.
So this is something to develop offline, but I want to ask Tina, do you see any opportunity to do this in Moscow?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I think it could be done.
And does anybody who is online see an opportunity to do this in any of the studies that are ongoing or planned?
I think it's possible, both in terms of Phil Mays as well as in terms of the other cohort in South Africa right now.
Yeah.
I think it's possible in both of them.
Because we're talking, and again, I apologize, I don't know this literature very well, but we're talking about something that's at least easy to do.
Right.
The neonatal ultrasound is really easy.
No, I'm talking about the habituation.
The habituation.
Yeah.
Habituation.
I frankly think that it's easier to do the neonatal ultrasound than it is the habituation.
Well, it may not be in the field, though. I mean, the Brazelton is out there.
Yeah, but I'm telling you that a lot of people who set out to use the Brazelton in a neonatal cohort failed to get, I mean, you'd have to be really careful to be sure that your people insisted the way we did that you would get the child in the right state of sleep.
Yeah.
And for babies that, you know, that have problems, that isn't always the easiest thing.
Well, I think, you know,
but the neonatal ultrasound is so simple because, you know, it just takes a few minutes. It doesn't, you know, the baby just sits on the mother's lap and you just do it, or lies on the crib. You don't have to do anything special,
of course,
in order to evaluate it.
But they're very different. And one of
yeah.
the structural study and the other is possibly the first behavioral
Yeah.
neurologic study, and they
you could do them both.
They tell us something different. So I think
yeah.
that's something to park for the moment, and we'll get back to it and see
uh-huh.
how that idea could be developed.
Sure.
This is Ed Riley.
Ed, how are you?
I'm all right, and I apologize, and I'm very ill prepared because all my notes are on my desk in my office, and I'm at home.
I've got them in front of me.
Okay. So, but I'm listening now.
Did you just come on?
Just got on. I just heard Anne's last comments on situation versus neonatal ultrasound.
Right. A thought that came up, and you can probably answer this question for us, is that Anne was commenting that failure of habituation to light was the most sensitive item in her studies over the first 7 years of life. And the question that I asked that you may be able to answer is, have animal studies looked for something similar? And what has been found?
In young animals, not neonates, but young animals, habituation to objects has been studied and found to take longer for them to habituate. They also take longer to habituate to odors. There are data, and these are animals that I believe would probably be between 18 and 35 days of age. So more in the early adolescent.
And that's failure to habituate both to olfactory as well as tactile?
Yes. Not tactile, but just novelty.
Uh-huh.
It's a task where the animals are put into a compartment where there are holes in the floor with objects in those holes. And you just see how long it takes them to stop nose poking into the holes to explore the objects.
So the idea that came up was whether Anne's finding and the method of testing for it is something that could be introduced at multiple sites in those studies where there are cohorts that are going to be studied from birth on, and to what extent that could be combined with other metrics this morphology, neonatal ultrasound, and so on, to provide some early correlation between a morphological and a behavioral measurement. We'll park that and move on in the interest of time. What I asked at the beginning, Ed, as we go through these, is for people to begin to come up with an idea of how the proposal would be packaged as a UO1 and how much it would cost, with the idea that down the line, not too far down the line, we're going to have to prioritize projects and maybe take some apart and put them together with others to be able to bring this in under budget. So we're just going through them now with that in mind.
Okay.
And then the next set is Elizabeth, and I wonder if you can just present yours.
Right. Well, essentially the aim was to, you know, help improve diagnosis using the brain, quantitative brain mapping techniques that I've used on, mostly on, well, in Sarah's population and now on the population that I'm collecting here at UCLA, and to do a careful job of quantifying relationships between facial morphology that we can measure with the imaging data or the MRI imaging data, and to try to combine that somehow with, I don't know how, but with the facial imaging. You know, essentially the goals would be about the same as it was the first time, only this time I think as a project perhaps it would move more, be more productive if I'm supervising and facilitating data collection at, you know, two of the sites where we're, you know, already good at doing that, mine and in San Diego, and then South Africa. I have a colleague here who's from South Africa, and she's willing to and excited about, interested in supervising that part of data collection, so she would travel there as frequently as needed. And she does essentially the same thing I do, only with schizophrenia populations. So she's very adept and well-published in collecting data.
You mentioned Finland. It's the only place on...
Well, and I think I said Finland as much because Ed told me to say that, because I really know what the possibilities are there. But you know, if they're imaging, which I know they are, I just got an email from the people there recently, that to really facilitate getting the structural MRI data, that I could do that.
Right. I guess the question arises again as to whether we want to have a limited number of sites with well-characterized cohorts from which to generate the data that you're referring to, and whether Finland would be in that or not.
Yeah. I honestly feel pretty strongly from what I've been hearing that South Africa would be a very good place to do it, other than the places we are. But I really don't have a strong sense about
that. Yeah, because the places that pop up repetitively in our smaller list of sites are Russia, San Diego, the Plains, and
well,
South Africa.
Yeah. I mean, I think we pretty much know that Moscow's not a good place for it.
Mm-hmm.
But the Plains Indians, I thought about that too, but I didn't. Yeah, I don't know what the possibilities are there.
Okay.
Yeah.
For an imaging study, what's the youngest population that you would use?
Well, you know, I like to study kids. The imaging studies I have to do, FASD kids currently, it is we're going as young as 7. And we're not looking at kids who are severely impaired, so we're looking at minimum IQ. I believe we said 80. But, you know, for structural imaging, you know, I was just working with some people who are doing an autism project, and they were talking about scanning infants age 6 months, 12 months. So, you know, actually, younger infants are a little bit easier to study than infants, you know, who are more like toddlers, because you can get them habituated and default. Well, I don't know how well they would habituate, actually, based on what I've just been hearing. But so anyway, you can put them in the scanner, though. It's not a fun thing to do. I mean, it requires a lot of a lot of work with the infants to get them, again, habituated. And usually the scans are done between 9 p.m. and midnight, and it's really not a lot of fun. So I think you'd have to have a really strong reason to say why we would want to do it in younger kids as opposed to, you know, school age.
Ken, do you know about the imaging capabilities at Stellenbosch?
Yeah, they have very good imaging capabilities there, I'm fairly certain. George Fine is doing a study there right now with older individuals. And he told me that they have equipment just as good as what he has in San Francisco. The issue there, and there's a lot of equipment around that's available. I was told that by Dennis Vilhoun. The issue in South Africa, I think, is going to be getting a collaborator who is there who does imaging.
Yeah.
And the other issue is the population, because the only the two new prospective populations, which is the past population and Phil May's population, are very young. First being born. In fact, many of them are first being conceived. Okay, now Phil May did have the population that he studied, the three retrospective waves that he's had over the last 10 years. Wellington, which is a good, that's a good 30 miles outside of outside of Stellenbosch.
Yeah, I was thinking of the kids that are in the intervention study right now who'd be...
They're the ones in Wellington.
Yeah, and Stellenbosch would be the closest facility, I would have
thought. I would assume you can get them back and forth. It's about a half...
It's the logistics of, you have to arrange for drivers and things like that.
Yeah, it's about a half hour, 45-minute trip going back and forth with the driver.
That's not undoable.
No, that's not undoable.
So these kids would already have the neurobehavioral. Although when
they would have they'd have the battery that's been done.
But would it have been done years before we'd actually scan them, or would it have been?
No, it'd be done within the last year and a half.
Because if we get it too far, then their cognitive skills will have changed between when we scan them, and so might have to be redone.
Right.
Okay. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Well, just, budgets. I can give you an idea of how much it would cost to do the study here, scanning the kids and doing, neurobehavioral and that sort of thing. But, so how much it would cost overall for the project would depend on, whether or not, say, the sites who are going to scan would subcontract, and then the other issue is the sites where it's like, I have currently funding to scan FASD kids, though they're not part of the consortium, but they, could be. If people already have some money to do scanning, so they don't need the money for scanning, I just don't know. So
if you could just project something with those different contingencies.
Yeah. So I know to do a study, kind of bare bones, and it's an expensive area to work in, but say we did 20 FASD and 20 control kids a year, that's about $40,000 for scanning per year. And then, I would need two full-time RAs, one to collect data and work with the families and do, neuropsych, and one to do more image analysis type stuff. So I mean a minimum of 200.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's probably not enough, but minimum.
That's in the and in South if we did it in South Africa, it would be cheaper.
Yeah. It would be cheaper. Okay, yeah. I didn't know about that.
A scan there in a good instrument is about $200.
Oh wow. Okay. So here it's $600 an hour, and we usually have to spend more than an hour. And you have subject payments and...
Yeah, and the personnel costs there are much cheaper.
So I don't know, that's my idea. So again, it would be about the same as we wanted to do, only it would be more of a project, I think, because I would be supervising data collection. I would be analyzing the data instead of well, you know, with collaborative, obviously, goals. And it would focus more on quantification of the face, which I really couldn't do in the first proposal.
Elizabeth and I have talked about this, and I think we've come to the conclusion that it would serve be better served as a UO1 rather than a core.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I don't want to hog any more time, but the only other thing was I had a couple of ideas about, you know, combining the animal and human with, I don't know if we should talk about that. I mean, it almost seems like maybe when Fang talks, maybe we could add a little bit on that.
Well, it's also one of the things that I wanted to bring up today.
Okay.
Because we now have animal imaging facilities, or at least they project that we're going to have them within the next month.
Uh-huh.
With a dedicated animal imager here at UCSD.
Uh-huh. So we have currently the people doing the mouse stuff here scanning at Caltech. So that would be a possibility, though I just got an email from the Brain Mapping Center director, John Mazzietta, saying they're in the process of getting a 7T magnet here. So I would, you know, that'll probably take 2 years, so, but it's feasible.
That's what we have here now.
But at the very least, we are currently in the Laboratory of Neuroimaging collaborating with Caltech and sending the animals, or the heads, I guess, of the animals there for scanning and then analyzing the data here.
Okay.
So
we're just,
you know,
we're just surveying now, but that's in your proposal.
Yeah, and I don't know if it would be part of my proposal or a different proposal or someone else would write it and collaborate with us or what.
But,
I mean, I'm not a mouse person. The technology is here, and it's working for other projects, so I just thought I'd let you all know that.
Yeah.
Ken, do you think that the multiple PI option is going to be available?
I think that's going to move fairly slowly in NIH. It's only in the roadmap right now, so I don't expect that there's going to be great speed on that.
Okay.
So it's possible if someone else were going to, you know, write their you know, do their animal work and then have this as a sub-project, you know, that we could find people here at the Laboratory of Neuroimaging could analyze or scan the animals. I don't know. Something like that could be interesting.
Okay. Let's move on to Feng Zhou.
The basic science part over Indiana has developed it into two directions. And one is a diagnosis that involves the facial. The other one is continual for the therapeutic treatments with ADNF. The ones on the diagnosis have developed into a correlation between animal and the human facial dysmorphology diagnosis. At this point, I think we are beginning to talk about what are the technical possibility to correlate the common features of the human parts as well as the animal parts. Down the road, what we are hoping for is to find a confirmed previous diagnosis criteria, and meanwhile, looking for the new ones that is the not being used in the past. Hopefully, this can be address FAS, perhaps FAE, that is not traditionally being seen with the very obvious dysmorphology, such as in the face. At this point, I think what we have working with the Xiaofeng, Jeffrey Huang, and Elizabeth together is to put together a larger population in both animal and human, be able to educate the computer to have a better intelligent diagnosis for the diagnosis part.
Mm-hmm.
We can probably talk about therapeutical parts if we go on for the next.
I think that's outlined pretty clearly in what you've written. And I don't have a written summary. I've discussed this before, but Keith Miller and my lab has been talking about extending the work that we're doing with L1 and trying to crystallize L1, at least a piece of L1, the part that we've labeled already, in the absence and presence of ethanol, to try to develop a physical footprint of what an alcohol antagonist binding site might look like in real structural three-dimensional space. And that would be one project that we would submit. And I've begun to have some discussions with others in the field, and we'll bring something forward shortly to talk about other basic science projects could mesh with the themes of this particular consortium. A lot of that is actually summarized because Feng Zhou's numbered list under mechanisms and therapeutics is pretty broad, and these would be contained within that. Sarah's not on, is that right?
Sorry?
Sarah?
I don't know.
Yeah, Sarah in her notes says she can't do Thursdays.
Okay.
So that may be, that's one of her recommendations is that we move the meetings to a day other than Thursday.
Okay. We'll have to look for that by email.
It's okay, I'm on a conference call.
It takes too long. Anyway, Sarah's proposal, Ed, do you want to just describe it, or I have it in front of me, maybe I
can. I don't have any notes here. I'm
Her specific aims are again, to continue with the data collection for children with FAS using the battery that's been developed in the neurobehavioral core at multiple sites. She lists a large number of sites. Most of these are sites where data has already been collected, and then to try to refine the battery and perhaps add measures. And that's directed at the ultimate, one of the ultimate phenotypes, one of the ultimate goals of the first round of this consortium, which is trying to identify the phenotype, especially in non-dysmorphic children. And the strategy is to, first of all, to complete the task of doing a detailed neurobehavioral profile in kids who are dysmorphic, to then extend those data to the non-dysmorphic population to see where overlaps are or degrees of difference are, and then to continue to correlate those findings with facial imaging data and brain imaging data. She has under additional notes from the conference call, and I'll just ask her questions for those who are on. Can intervention studies be done in Moscow and San Diego? Behavioral profiles are similar. Problem is that in Moscow you can probe for IQ, which reduces differences between groups. Answer, in terms of San Diego, maybe. Depends on sample requirements and details of the intervention. Would likely be very expensive. And she talks about one particular intervention, which is neurofeedback, which is $5,000 per person per month, which might be prohibitively expensive. So those are Sarah's comments. Jennifer?
She's not on. She has class.
Okay. Jennifer has class, but she proposes behavioral and educational interventions and expanding on Phil May's findings, looking at educational interventions applied to additional populations, possibly in Moscow. Another aim has to do with expanding the work that she's done in animals, looking at possible choline supplementation or other nutritional interventions in children with FASD, and proposes beginning with small-scale experiments, perhaps in South Africa. And then an additional aim is to look at biomarkers in meconium to assist in diagnosis. And then the last aim was to collect blood or tissues to get at genetic and nutritional or risk protective factors. And in terms of basic science, to look more fundamentally at the interaction of nutritional variables with alcohol and to identify combinations of pharmacotherapies, nutritional and behavioral interventions that could change the trajectory after birth. Phil May essentially agreed with the sentiments that were expressed at the last call, wants to continue educational interventions, which are showing some positive results, and felt that this could be done in the more narrow number of sites that we discussed the last time, and mentioned that he's going to be beginning a 5-year comprehensive community prevention trial in South Africa, but that's dependent on funding that's working its way through the system at NIAAA. And then finally, some comments from Ken Jones. Ken is not on the call, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Extending the dysmorphology core to provide exams to all sites, particularly the prospective sites in Moscow and South Africa, and also to the retrospective sites that are collecting additional data. And he proposes to look at 3 things: blinded physical exams that can be correlated with animal data and computer images, correlations of morphological data with brain imaging using particularly palpebral fissure measurements, and then a new study looking at evaluation of the lingular frenulum using assistance from the imaging core. So that's what we have. I think to move forward with this, we need to go to the next stage of refinement, which involves some projection of what the costs would be. And based on the conversations that we've had today and at the previous discussion, not an expansion, but a consolidation of the ideas so that each can be presented as potentially a single project with a price tag. And I think at that point, we could look at whether the proposals are feasible, whether they need to be reformulated by mixing and matching from other proposals that might not stand on their own, given budgetary limitations and the need to prioritize, and then finally to come up with a mechanism for figuring out exactly what projects we're going to go forward with on the renewal.
A couple comments. Are we interested in soliciting proposals from other people that, you know, so far have not been involved in these calls? I know that INYAS, for example, you know, put out calls to other investigators who were not involved in the original one to saying, here's what we have now in terms of our models.
Yeah.
Who's interested in becoming involved?
I think that that would be valuable, but how would you do it?
Well, I mean, we could say that for the renewal of the consortium, we are soliciting other ideas, other projects, and send it out to the fetal alcohol study group.
I think before we answer that, we have to check on to see what some of the changes have been here at NIH in terms of the rules and regulations related to letters of invitations and RFAs, because whatever we do is going to have to be consistent with what the call is from, with what the regulation and policies are. So we're going to have to double check on that. I did put an inquiry in already to some people in Building 1, and they did not get back to me on it, so I'm just going to have to pursue it a little more.
All righty.
Okay. Could I make another comment? And that is, one of the things you need to also be thinking about and considering is what cores do you consider essential and would want to continue, and what cores could be, in other words, are there some cores where the the work that they did. They've established the infrastructure that's needed, and therefore the core doesn't need to be a core, a standalone core anymore. Because one of the criticisms has been that there are more cores, or almost as many more cores than there are projects.
Right. I think that what done is to have the administrative core basically include the informatics core as one possibility. The pilot project core would just be subsumed under the administrative core.
Have you passed that by Craig, Ed?
Pardon?
Have you passed that by Craig?
No.
Okay. Because I expect that.
But there's an administrative cluster, and you know, as we're functioning now, and rather than have that cluster, make it a core.
I understand where it's coming from. I just also know that one of the driving reasons for us to get involved here was that we got to say we had an NIH grant that was ours.
Okay.
I don't have any problem with the data informatics core.
Okay. All right. So then, but the administrative core then could assume the pilot project core. So that's not a standalone
project.
Yes.
And you have other cores too, like, you know, for example, the dysmorphology core, which could, you know, really be a dysmorphology project.
Ken and I, Tina, are you here?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we had discussed that as a possibility of what the dysmorphology core wanted to try to accomplish, since they're not going to have to go do these massive scans anymore of large populations with existing populations. If we had new ones, then they would. So, like, the neurobehavioral core basically could come under the administrative because it's going to get relatively small. The brain imaging core will now be a project, and I'm assuming that perhaps a facial imaging core would also be a project rather than a core.
Certainly in terms of facial imaging, I assume in terms of the brain imaging as well, but I think that's going to sit much better as a project than as a core.
So I think that the number of cores will, in fact, become much smaller. So we'll have an administrative core, an informatics core.
Right.
And
you have multiple that we have multiple populations that we're studying, and the projects are basically working across these multiple populations. Is the motivation for them to continue as part of CFAS?
Will the project be including the human as well as the animal component?
Yes. But not necessarily both within a project.
Right. But when it's needed or is completed.
I think it's best to conceive these as self-contained UO1s and see what we come up with.
And there's going to have to be strong collaborations. For example, if you're going to be correlating facial imaging data with brain mapping, then there's going to have to be a very close relationship between those two groups in terms of how they...
Right.
In terms of how they what?
In terms of how you put your applications together.
Right. And I think that's the quintessential aspect of this as a consortium, which is that why are these UO1s and not RO1s, is that there will be a high level of collaboration, and the collaboration will be based on the foundation of having these multiple populations and common goals that we're trying to achieve. I think that a group of UO1s that don't require collaboration, even if they address the common mission, might be considered as potential freestanding RO1s.
In this case, you indicated it's physical collaborations. There's action to do things together.
Yes.
So it might be an idea to visualize this as clusters of UO1s that interrelate and kind of try to integrate them and put them together into these clusters of facial imaging or whatever.
Ed, you indicate the cluster is as a functional cluster to address this particular issue in questions, right?
Right.
Okay, let me do this. Let me summarize the next task and send it out. And we're due to talk in a month, but there's a question of whether the time that we have is the right one, so we might explore another time as well. And that can be done offline.
Joanne, can you see if you can find another time?
Correct. Will do.
Thank you. All right.
Good. Thank you all for your time, and I'll try to get something out.
Can I ask one question before we all go?
Yeah.
I feel like I need to know who to talk to about the South Africa potential for scanning before I can really get an idea.
Probably a little early.
I mean, I hear so many names, and I just don't know. Is it Phil to talk to, or?
Yeah, if we're talking about the only population that we have right there right now, which is not infants,
mm-hmm.
is Phil May's population.
Okay, so I should contact him.
The first person, but then it's a matter of us finding, and probably myself and Lori could make the connections overall in terms of the Stellenbosch people for access to an imaging facility there.
Okay.
Maybe contact Dan Stein and see what he suggests.
Yeah, Dan Stein is clearly a possibility. He's at
me contact him?
No, let Ken.
Yeah, okay. Just want to clarify.
Right. Okay.
So I can talk to Phil. Okay.
Okay.
Elizabeth, you also mentioned about animal imaging. So I think we can provide this aspect.
Okay. And then Ed might be interested too, it sounds like.
Yes.
So we should talk about that somehow.
And Ken, Warren, can you stay on for a minute?
Yeah, I was going to give you a call.
Okay. Well, just give me a call then back at my house.
I have your home number. I'll give you a call as soon as we hang up.
All righty. Thanks.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Thanks, Paul. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.